Hello, and welcome to the Comedian's Paradise. This is a podcast where I speak to amazing mavericks, characters, and honestly, James Bonds from across the comedy world. Now, today's guest is Daniel. He's been gigging for a while. He's a comedy promoter. He's the mayor of Sheffield Comedy. And he has a surname that's pronounced like Guinness. Welcome to the stage, the brilliant Daniel Innes.
Thank you very much, Marvin. It's lovely to be here. Been looking forward to this.
Thank you for coming in. Now I can see you've got a lovely backdrop. It's a lot. Well, the thing about people with a podcast, well, this is on audio, so they don't see the backdrop. Normally I have a colourful background that hides what goes on here, but look at this. You've got the I don't know what it looks like from you.
It's cool. It's good. It's good.
And you got as well, like, is it, if I woke up and I'd thought I'd gone to heaven, I think I'd wake up in your room because it's got the right colour for it.
Yeah, it's nice and bright. It's my office where I do a lot of my comedy writing and a lot of different stuff. So I like it fairly bright. So it's let in some nice lighting. So we're all good.
Yeah. And tell us a bit about your story, Daniel. How did you become the mayor of comedy in Sheffield?
Give me a very grandiose kind of title there. I think like most people who aspire to be comedians, you get nudged into it by people who say, you think you're funny, Daniel, why don't you try comedy? And that was basically how I started. A friend of mine, Jordan, had said, you're always cracking jokes and you think you're funny. Why don't you get into comedy and go on a comedy course? And that's what I did. I went on an 8-week course 5 years ago. 2 hours a week with the delightful ending of doing my first gig in front of 197 people at Bramall Lane.
Oh!
I did 5 to 7 minutes. I was supposed to do 5 to 7 minutes. It actually went really, really well that the mentor who actually was the MC on the night, Kate, said, carry on. I ended up doing 11, 12 minutes and just got such a buzz out of it. But yeah, it was really good. My knees were knocking first time because I looked through the curtain and saw so many people. And yeah, 197 people. So I thought, yeah, this is for me.
Oh, okay. And was it Jordan Peterson?
No. It wasn't Jordan Peterson.
Was it Jordan the glamour model?
It was Jordan of the male variety.
Oh, okay. And Jordan Kitt, that's his name, Jordan Kitt.
We'll call him Jordan X.
Jordan X, okay. And how was it? I mean, all I know about Sheffield United, Bramall Lane, from the enthusiasm you said there, I'm guessing there's a part of you that likes the football club.
Actually, no, because I was born in Huddersfield.
Oh, okay, sorry.
I'm a Huddersfield Town fan, so living here in Sheffield and living in South Yorkshire for now 15 years, the rivalry, you only get to really sense the rivalry between the two teams when you live here because they really don't like each other, Sheffield Wednesday and Sheffield United. And I think there's something like 6 miles or so between the two grounds and hostile territory sometimes.
Oh, okay. So I got
hostile territory. Telling you.
But, oh, okay, that must have been, you got to make people laugh in your rival stadium.
Exactly. And where I live, I'm literally 5 minutes drive from Hillsborough. So the Sheffield Wednesday side of the city. And as I say, the intense rivalry, you can go into many a bar, a pub or a restaurant. And if you mention the wrong club at the wrong time, you're in for quite a conversation, let's say.
Oh, bloody hell. Is it not like friendly rivalry?
No, they detest each other. They really do. And I think it's most rivalries up and down the country, whether it be the Manchester rivalry, the Merseyside rivalry, the Bristol rivalry, has that element to it. But you only really get to see it and feel it once you actually live in the city. Because when I lived in Huddersfield, born and bred, growing up, didn't really recognise how kind of volatile that rivalry was.
Oh, God.
And it is.
Do you hide that from people in Sheffield?
Well, to be fair, I mean, Huddersfield are quite an innocent club. So even if I say I support Huddersfield here in Sheffield, it's sort of okay. It's acceptable. Rather than if I said I support Leeds United.
Sheffield Wednesday. That's where it gets a bit.
Yeah, or even the Sheffield sides. I mean, yeah, there's a big rival with Leeds as well down here. So yeah.
Oh, bloody, yeah. And that's a bit like comedy as well. Comedy seems to end like that in certain, each city has its own bunch of cliques and they hate each other.
Yeah. You do get that. But I like to think that there's more great people in comedy than those individuals.
Oh, yes, definitely. Well, that's one of the thing that I like about comedy is, we're all so different. And it attracts a very interesting bunch of people. Like, we say things that a lot of people would never say in a pub pub conversation. We say a lot of truths. Yeah. And one reason why I do the podcast is there's such a dynamic range of people in it. And that's what I love about it, the people in comedy. There's such a wild variety. And there's some things that don't make any sense, but there's always something to talk about with comedy.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I think it's good that we do have those conversations, but can have it in a comedic way as well.
Yeah. It's great. There's bits that I don't like about comedy, but even the bits that I don't like about it, I still love in a way.
No, I get that. And I see that when I'm gigging all over the country as well as the nights that I have.
And what have you found like with the Sheffield? You said before we started the podcast that Sheffield has a very comedy savvy audience. How do you rate that in terms of other cities that you go down to across the UK in terms of their humour, the clubs and like the...
I think most comedy cities and towns have got comedy savvy people. I'm just quite biased because I love the city of Sheffield. But I've gigged in Liverpool, in Newcastle, in Birmingham, in London, and they've all got comedy savvy people. And I think those comedy savvy people are the ones that generally go to gigs a lot as well, and they know how to behave in the comedy environment. They know the do's and don'ts, and they're very respectful to acts. And I think that's a massive, massive thing. But we have it in abundance here in Sheffield, and I think in Yorkshire as well in general, because of that northern humour that we've got. I think you can go anywhere up and down the country and you will get comedy savvy people. It's just that I'm very, very lucky that I have 5-6 nights here in Sheffield where I see it regularly.
And what's your feeling when you see, maybe when you get a video from an act and you're a bit unsure of them before they're going to bill, but then when you see them live, they absolutely storm it and you get pleasantly surprised and then you end up booking them for your other gigs. What's that feeling like?
Well, do you know what? I stopped watching videos ages ago of comedians because I think for two reasons. Nobody will send you a crap video unless it is crap. And secondly, I love to see the whites of comedians' eyes on stage. I'm very fortunate. I have a development night here in Sheffield every single first Monday of the month where I will get comedians that either I've never gigged with or I've never seen to come to Sheffield and play to an intimate crowd of 15, 20, 25, 30 people kind of thing. And it's a nice intimate gathering. It's a nice intimate venue. And I can see the whites of that comedian's eyes and see how they do their crowd work, how they deliver the pace, the tempo. And all these things are very, very important because, as I said, videos can be quite misleading.
Yeah, because it's their highlights. And if the act's done incredibly well before them, like opening the show, and the MC, they can sometimes be made to look better than their level.
Yeah. And nobody will send you, as I said, a rubbish video unless it is a rubbish video. But I think it's easier to do it that way than it is to say, right, come along to this night. You've got 10 minutes. It's going to be a nice, friendly, warm crowd. Let's see what you can do.
And what's been a memorable experience that you've had in Sheffield at gigs where you've learnt from watching another comic do badly?
Just the resilience, because I think it takes a hell of a lot of guts for anyone to get up on stage and deliver stand-up. And I've got respect for anybody that has done it once or a million times, because I think it is the hardest entertainment art form. I think if you're a singer or an actor, it's quite prescriptive. You know what you're going to do. Yes, you might need to ad-lib a little bit, but with comedy, you've got so many things that can go against you and you've got to be able to think on your feet. And that respect that I have for anybody who's done badly, and when I say badly, that's maybe had a bad day at the office, but come back and shown resilience, I think is brilliant.
Okay. And with the Yorkshire scene, is it it's a very big scene, isn't it? It's quite like comes from like, what have you? What would you say the community is like? So in London, you could probably gig every night of the week, maybe twice a week, even on the open mic level. What's it like in Sheffield? I'm guessing you can't gig that much from the way that you mentioned monthly gigs. But how do you make the most of the gigs that you get?
But you can't. Well, here in Sheffield, since I started, the scene has just gone straight through the roof. It really has. There were. It was very sparse for comedy nights. And then a few of us who started more or less at the same time started putting nights on that became very, very successful. So there's enough nights in and around Sheffield and around Yorkshire. And we're not a million miles away from Manchester, where you can generally go here, there and everywhere and just migrate around and gig. So that's not too much of an issue now. You can actually go and ply your trade in three or four different cities that are fairly, not massively close to each other, but are fairly close. So it probably is like going from one end of London to another or from east to west kind of thing.
On the tube, okay.
Yeah.
And how do you find the audiences in Manchester or in Liverpool compared with like...
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Love gigging over there in Manchester and Liverpool. Very receptive. Love to have a great night out. And this is all that we want as performers, people to come out and enjoy themselves. And I think Manchester, Liverpool, Leeds, Sheffield, Newcastle, they have that in abundance.
And have you... Okay. Is the humour different in those cities? Or would you say it's just good punchlines, good jokes, just be aware of them as individuals?
Yeah, I think it's not different. I think comedy is comedy, but I think the divide is, when I've gigged in London, there's a difference in terms of the northern humour transferring to the southern audiences and maybe vice versa. I think that's the skill of a comic then that has to then just maybe read the room and change a few things, to tweak a few things. But that comes with experience as well. But in terms of the northern cities, I think the northern humour translates from city to city up here. I think we understand each other.
Ah, okay. One thing I've heard from comedians that gig a lot in the north is that they said there's more of a going out culture than...
Yeah.
Well, what one comedian said that, Mel O'Rourke, said that there's more of a going out culture up north than there is down south.
I would agree with that 100%. I think there is. And again, using Sheffield as an example, for the nights that I promote and gig around here, people are making it an event to go out for the evening. So comedy may start 8 o'clock, but people are going out from about 6:30, 7 o'clock, having something to eat pre-gig, and then enjoying the gig, which sometimes the gigs don't finish until 10:30. So they make it's an event, and I think that's a really, really good thing.
Yeah. And what have you noticed? I've heard that in the north, you guys like to get involved a lot more than in the south. Is that true?
We do. We're very hands-on. I think promoters, MCs, comedians, we all see it as a team game up here. I'm not saying they don't dance up, but in my experience up here, we all see it as a team game. And I think that again lends itself to really, really good nights and positive nights.
And does what's the so you've got lots of things going on in Yorkshire, Sheffield. What How do you handle some of the joke? I'm not going to mention that. I'll keep that on the down. I saw a post that you were on the forum. I'm going to keep that on the down. Don't worry.
No, you can. We can talk about it. It's fine.
Sure. Okay. So I saw a post online that you put on about there's some promoter that's saying this or there's this saying that. What's going on here, and how can comedians sort of handle the rubbish in comedy?
I think
drama.
The one thing in my time doing this is that I don't think people should be going public, but I felt as though there was a need for me to go public because I think there's an unwritten rule in comedy that I've always lived by, that you don't slate or slander a lineup in public. If an individual has a problem with a night or a lineup, speak to the promoter directly, direct message them, ask for their phone number and speak to them without actually going public. So I think I basically did that because I was protecting a lineup who didn't deserve the comments that were made. And it was just I felt well, the right thing to do, and the support from comedians and promoters after that was overwhelming.
So he I mean, maybe they had a bad gig, but so he made fun. He said some brutal things about them, and you were.
Well, there was one thing that when you were saying that he didn't feel that the lineup was worth the entrance fee, and that was public. But the devil's in the detail, Marvin, because for that money, for the £10 on a Friday night, you got free food, you got discounted beer, you got four comics. And I thought, such brilliant value for money. And we had it was fun to burst in. Everybody enjoyed themselves. I did put a little naughty video up about it. And it was just a brilliant success. So much so that, as I said, we do that night every 2 months. And it's already half booked.
Ah, okay.
In terms of audience buying the tickets.
I bloody wish that. I've been trying to put some sort of deals and things with venues in London. It's a bloody lot of hard work, but yeah. Okay. So cool. So it was just you're watching the comedians back effectively.
Yeah. And I would do that every single day of the week because I think I might have seen lineups and thought, oh, I didn't know how that would work or whatever. I wouldn't go online and have a public show about it. But the irony of it is, there was two people that did it. The first person that started it actually apologised publicly to me, which was nice.
Yeah. It is. But comedy is a very emotional game, though. It is an emotional game.
And there's a lot of insecurities.
I feel that sometimes with performing arts, some of us come into it as damaged people. And we think that the art's going to help solve our problems. And,
yeah.
But that's correct. Not true. No matter what level you get at, the problem's got to be sorted out inside. Yeah. Comedy's not going to sort it out for you. It helps.
Yeah.
But definitely, if you're successful. But like, it's not going to sort what's inside.
No, you're right.
Do you feel like sometimes when you meet your heroes, not with comedian heroes, but sometimes when I see, occasionally when I've bumped into famous people, this and that, you know, they're just people at the end of the day and they've been successful, but the problems that me and you have are still with them. And maybe their problems have gotten worse because some of them have thought that, oh, it's going to sort all their issues out, and they've not addressed it before they've got famous.
Yeah. I agree. I think that there is an element of that. And I've been fortunate enough to gig with some household name comedians and found that so far, everyone that I've met that I obviously anticipated meeting and thinking, wow, I'm looking forward to meeting this individual, has been great. I've not had a negative experience with those that can be deemed as heroes of yours and stuff.
Now, I've heard that as well. But at the end of the day, the point I'm getting at is they're people.
Yeah.
They're not. I think I need to get this in my head as well. Whoever you see as famous or this and that, they're still a person at the end of the day. Yeah. They're not like some godly figure.
No, exactly.
That's what I feel anyway. But I've seen it. If I see someone that I admire, I think I'll probably still go into the fangirl thing. And then I think, why the fuck did I do that? They're just a normal person.
Yeah, exactly. And I always say that, you know what, fame or no fame, they still sit on the toilet in the same way. So it's true, isn't it? I mean, it's we treat them like sometimes too big. And it can be intimidating, but I think it helps when they're generally nice people as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's been someone that you've met that you've been famous as a comedian that you've been surprised by?
None of them. I've not been so... I think everyone that I've met... So I've gigged with John Richardson, gigged with Nick Helm, gigged with Dan Renton Skinner, whose character is Angelos Epifemu. These people are really, really talented and really, really nice and lend their time really, really well. And it was a pleasure to be part of the same lineup or on the same night as these people. Ask me again, maybe in a year or two, and I've met a few more, and I might have a different opinion of those individuals, the new people I met, but especially those three, really, really nice individuals that I just think to myself, yeah, it was a pleasure to actually be around them and learn and pick things up, and a couple of them I call friends.
But what do they surprise you with things that they do backstage in terms of, not in terms of behavior in the bad, and I'm said like, you, when you watch them, say like John Richardson, you have an image of him being a certain way. If you watch Mate at 10 Cats or Does Countdown, you have an image of him, but it does, are they slightly different to their stage, to what they are? And
most definitely. And I think that's the worry that you have, isn't it, when you when you come across certain people, you think, oh, are they going to be divas? Are they going to be hard to work with? But when you have these people, you see them backstage and everything, as you said, you highlight, these are just normal people who do what they do in their craft very, very well. But I also think that the big test of any of these individuals, and I try and do it myself with my experience, is to pass experience on, pass knowledge on. And all of those people did that.
Okay. Can I ask what they are? No, I'm joking.
No, you can ask anything.
What was a interesting bit of advice that you've received from someone higher up like that you didn't think of?
I got some advice when I first started. I was reaching out to all manner of comedians for advice. So I reached out to Jack Whitehall and to Gary Delaney, and Gary Delaney was brilliant with me. So Gary Delaney's Sarah Millican's husband, but he's such a great comic. Really, really is. He's one of my heroes. And I didn't expect him to get back to me. And he was mentioning the fact that keep writing, don't just always keep the funnies in your set, because it's about evolution, not revolution. And then at the end of it, he just said, enjoy it, and gave a lovely bit of advice at the end. He said, I look forward to sharing the stage with you one day. And for someone that you admire from afar as well, that was a big thing for me.
And they probably get tons and tons of messages, and for them to respond like that is lovely.
And he actually said to me, because I said, he's very generous with your time, Gary, and he just said, do you know what? I wish I had somebody with the experience that I have now got when I first started out in comedy. And that was why he was very giving, because he was saying, look, this game is hard enough as it is, but if someone can give you a couple of nuggets of their experience, then it's invaluable.
Okay. And on top of that, what I interviewed Luke McGibbon, who's a comedian, that wrote some great articles on like how to run a gig, developing material. He's from Northern Ireland, and he wrote a gig on The Good Delusion. But what are things that you notice in acts that, as a promoter, that you think that could be improved, that you notice that the common pitfalls that a lot of acts do when coming up? And what is something that you'd say in new nights that are coming up? What are common pitfalls you see with them?
Well, with new acts, I think it's trying to get so much new material out all at once. Because going back to the Gary Delaney stuff, he was saying to me, again, it's not revolution, it's evolution. Put nuggets of new things in, surrounded by the stuff that you know is going to land. And then it'll just gradually evolve, he said. And I've seen a lot of acts that, just saying, right, I've got all this new material, I've got half an hour of new material, I'm going to throw it all out there straight in one fell swoop kind of thing. And that's so dangerous, because you don't know what's going to land from what isn't. You also need to realise that if people are coming out to watch, you have a duty to entertain an audience. So why would you just throw everything all at once in terms of new stuff without having the safety net of stuff that you know is going to land, just so that you know what to use and when to use it? That's one thing that I see. For the new nights itself, if you have a new night, I think it's important that new night hits the ground running, and you've got to get quality on. So I've always said that if it's a new act night, I always get an experience opener, an experience closer, and then your middles have that safety net, because we've still got a duty to entertain people coming out for a night out. So I think it's quite easy just to have these new nights and just put six acts who probably have done less than, I don't know, 10, 15 gigs between them. Very, very dangerous, in my experience anyway.
And what about with MCing a gig? What would you say?
It's funny you should say that. I had I think MCs have got, MCing is very difficult. It really is. It's a different skill, because you've got to make sure that the comedians can ride the crest of the audience wave. You've got to get them up. I love MCing, I love gigging, but I would always say that if you're going to MC, you need to have gigs under your belt as a comedian. I don't think you can go in raw as an MC without having the fundamentals of being of gigging for a while, because the trade-off is that you still have to perform. You're the conduit between the audience and the comedians on that night. So you need to be able to work that room and read that room. And I think you gauge that by gigging, and then you can take those skills to MCing.
And what do you make of when you're having a bad night as an MC? How do you recover?
Touch wood, fortunately enough, I haven't had too many of them. So I think it's a case of, I've been on nights or been at gigs where the MC has struggled, but then if you're going on next, you don't want to be, if you've got a 10, 15, 20 minute set, you don't want to be spending the first 5, 6, 7 minutes warming the crowd up, because that's not your job. So I think my mantra has always been, I'm going to make sure you, as a member of the audience or the audience in general, are virtually ready to a frenzy for that next act to come on, so that they can ride that wave. And then that euphoria kicks in. I think it's then a skill that if that performer has had a bad day at the office, as an MC, it's my responsibility to raise that crowd back up for the next performer coming on as well.
Yeah. I've heard that a lot. Like Gareth Berliner made a really good point about that. And there's a guy that I'm trying to get on the podcast, Mark. Oh, I've forgotten his name. But Gareth Berliner said that, yeah, it may not be your job to warm up, but it's a team effort with gigs. And he said that go in as an opener, because that will get you a lot of paid work, but it really tests your mettle as a comic to go in as an opener.
Yeah, I think it's the hardest batting spot in the team, opening on a comedy night, I think. But I also think it's made easier, as I said, if the MC has, if the host has warmed that crowd up sufficiently to make it that little bit easier for the opener as well. I think it's such an important role, such an important job. And when I'm MCing, I usually have 5, 6, 7 minutes where I'm telling stories, I'm doing my crowd work, I'm mingling with the crowd and getting them to that frenzy. I keep using that word frenzy because I think it's very, very important that you get everyone up to a frenzy so that they are ready for that opening act.
And what are things that you wish you'd known at the start of your MCing that you know now?
Just to be as natural as you can be. Have some stories. Don't kill the night by over MCing, because that's an easy thing to do as well. You can go on too long. I think timing is right, and you should know when you look at your audience, yeah, they're ready for the opening act now, or they're ready for the next act now. And I think that comes with experience as well. I've seen MCs that virtually do a 20-minute set before they bring somebody out, and I think that is so wrong. That isn't what MCing is. You have to have stories. You have to have gags. You also have to be able to think on your feet. And I think that's a big, big thing as well, that you learn as you go along, that you've got to be sharp. You've got to think on your feet, and you've got to be able to be malleable enough to know how to read a room.
And how does that, there's a rumour that goes on that I hear so often in comedy. They say that if you're a good MC, you're going to be a good comedian. How much does that correlate to helping your stand-up being?
I think it does, yeah. I think it really does. It's helped me because, again, it's that ability to think on your feet. It's that ability to pace. It's that ability to do your crowd work as well. And I think that then can then transfer itself to sets and gigging itself. The two are different skills, but the two have skills that are aligned to each other as well.
They're like husband and wife.
They are. But as I say, I love gigging. I love MCing. I just think to myself, yeah, you've got to be a comedian if you're going to be an MC, though. You can't just go in raw as an MC because you'll just get eaten up.
What about the third cousin of MCing and being a comedian? What about promoting a gig? How does that improve your act?
But promoting a gig, I think, as we said off air to start with, I think you need a supportive venue and you need supportive people working for that venue, because the one thing that I try and instill into venues is this is your venue. You have to invest in this because you will gain benefit from your heavy lifting as well as my heavy lifting. I've seen so many venues who don't promote because they expect the promoter and the comedian to do it all. And that's why I'm not a massive fan of Brigham Nights either.
Do you get any of them up north?
It's a southern thing that we don't get any. We don't do it. I think it's a promoter's cop out or a venue's cop out, whoever decides that, because I just think, well, hang on, you're not gonna do my gig unless you bring one or two people with you. Well, no, I'm not a fan.
We southern softies and northern, yeah. The southern fairies. I'm not gonna say the other bit.
Do you know what? I might be wrong, but I don't know anywhere in Manchester, Leeds, Huddersfield, Newcastle, Sheffield that have Brigham Nights. Whenever I see them online, they're always down south.
And in London.
Yeah. And I just think it is a, I personally think it's a cop out.
I would like to gig a lot more up north and find out a bit more. I think there is a slight difference in, northerners like to go out more, but maybe there's more. I think a lot of the times in London, New York and LA, they can get away with these extreme practices because there's more access to TV and there's more people wanting to be famous and there's more comedians. So there's less spots, I suppose, maybe.
Yeah. Well, I guess so. I mean, it's probably, I think as you said off there before, it's probably a case of in London, you could throw a couple of stones between gigs because they are a lot closer to each other on the same night kind of thing. So I think that probably answers the question as to why some of them do have Brigham's, because they're thinking, well, if we're having to share the night with other people that's a stone throw away from us, then you bring people into us as well. And I just think it's that demand that if you want a 5-minute, 10-minute spot, you have to bring one or two people. I just think it is holding comedians or a comic to ransom a little bit.
Is it a bit like Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, where the guy says, listen, what was the name of the guy with the short guy that was threatening?
Oh, yeah. I know you mean.
What was this, some joke that... Oh, no, what was the bit that was really funny? I can't remember now, but there's lots of really funny. What was it called? Yeah, when the Lenny McLean says, you listen here, son. If you don't get these, you're going to be not be counting out the fingers you ain't got. All right.
Yeah, probably.
It is a bit like that, but normally with Bringer Nights, I've got a secret for anyone that's listening in now. I don't bother bringing anyone in. I'm running the chance here and not bother. It's a lot of effort, and I'm not bringing my friends to an open mic night. I'll bring them to a paid gig or something that's proper. I will not. Why would I want to do that to my friends?
Yeah. And I think, it just isn't a northern thing, as I said. When I first started seeing them years ago, I think, what is this? And then you look at it and thinking, well, promoters are saying you can't get 5 minutes on stage without bringing one person at least, or two people. Sometimes it's two people minimum.
Tell you what, one thing that would be funny is if you brought some virus to them or some disease or something. You said, listen, you want to bring someone? I said, yeah, I did. I brought Ebola here and I brought Corona here.
Yeah. Oh, my word. It's just madness.
Yeah, you could do a funny little sketch video on that, couldn't you?
Oh, dear.
So one thing I want to ask right now, what do you think, how did your previous life before comedy shape you to become a comedian, and how has comedy shaped you now?
Well, the previous life, I was a civil servant. So I used to work for Sheffield City Council. And as a comic, I always wanted to tell stories. And I just thought, well, you know what, I've got loads and loads of really funny stories, and that shaped comedy style, so to speak. But then doing this full time now and promoting full time, I just think that, again, it's evolution. It's that word evolution. You just sort of learn so many different things about yourself that you can actually put into funny stories, because funny things happen. And even if they don't happen to me, they're happening to my friends. And I just put, for comedy value, I just put myself in my friend's shoes if there's something funny that's happened to them. Sometimes I'll be a bit naughty and I'll name the friend kind of thing. it depends on whether they piss me off or something. I'd say, right, I'll tell you what, man. I'll tell you what, Fred, I'm going to make you famous tonight, kind of thing. So it's one of those, isn't it? But I think stories have shaped me, and I write a lot of stuff in terms of storytelling and gags. And it's, you know what comedy's like. Comedy's all stories, but exaggerated truths.
And how do you avoid the bit of doing therapy that makes people uncomfortable, which I see when it goes well, it's amazing. And people say, oh, yeah, I related to that. But when it goes badly, I've had my dad go to gigs, and he said occasionally, he said, listen here, I want to laugh. I don't want to hear about your story. What's your way of getting through that and making sure that things are punchy and not like a long-winded TED talk?
Yeah, well, I was always taught that it's bits, isn't it? Comedy's bits. You've got to keep stories with bits in, with gags all the way through before the big laugh. And I think if you've got a story that's engaging enough, then it'll have moments of laughter every 10, 15, 20 seconds to keep people engaged. Because nobody wants to come to a comedy show and listen to a monologue. They don't want that. They don't want to listen to a story where the first laugh is 3.5 minutes in. I was always taught, when you go on stage as a comedian, and I do this sometimes as an MC as well, get your first laugh within the first 15 seconds. Two reasons behind that. Reason number one, it relaxes you as a comic. Reason number two, it relaxes the audience. So there's not that pressure thinking, when's the first laugh? Then the laughs should come as bits after that 15 seconds until, obviously, whichever story you have leads to the big laugh. And you've got engagement then. You've got audiences that are engaged because they know that another laugh's coming every 10 seconds or every 15 seconds or every 8 seconds, and then there's going to be a big laugh in 35 seconds. And that keeps people on their toes as well.
And, yeah, so for anyone that's listening right now, if you were to describe the comedy journey in a short sentence, what would you describe it as? And how do people find out about you and your comedy nights?
I describe it as fun, loving, and just absolutely epic. Really, really love it. Love the whole comedy scene. Live for comedy. Socials, you can find me on Daniel Innes Comedy on Instagram. Daniel Innes on Facebook. It has all my nights. It has all the times I gig. It's got some little bits and bobs on there, clips and everything. So, yeah, I'm just like, I'm always on social media to promote my stuff as well as other stuff as well, because there's some very, very good promoters here in Sheffield and in Yorkshire, and I do believe that those, I love to work with them and promote their stuff as well. So, again, team effort.
And what would you describe the Sheffield culture and humour to anyone that's not listening?
Say that again?
How would you describe the Sheffield culture and humour?
Just fantastic. Comedy savvy, engaging, warm, ready, up for it, proper up for it with comedy. They really, really are. And I always find it a pleasure to gig in Sheffield for other promoters. I also find it a real pleasure when I'm promoting my nights, because I know that they are going to be fabulous nights with people coming. It's lovely to see new faces, but I'm very fortunate that I've got a bit of a following. So I see, and it's lovely when I see a lot of the same faces at my nights, because you know that that's an endorsement that you're doing well, and they're telling new people to come as well. And those new people that come to the nights, the new faces, just lap it up and they love it.
Okay. I hope you guys have enjoyed Daniel like a bottle of Guinness. No, like a glass of Guinness. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Share it with your friends. Give this podcast a 5-star review on Amazon and iTunes. And if you did not like it, send it to the grumpy git that you do not like.